He is Robin Leach. He is Jada Markin.
This is Car Keys.
Good day to our audience on this week's version of Car Keys with Jada Markin and Robin Leach. There seems to be a lot of things going on as we move into the fall-winter season and other things going on amongst the world automobile industry. And Jay and I will try to cover all those effectively for you. I have been talking too much about windshield wipers, according to my partner, Jay, but I do want to go. I've had a couple of people ask me questions about them, and I want to just give a couple of hints in a brief period right now. If your windshield wipers are chattering across your windshield, it is a clear signal that the blades have dried out and should be replaced. Clear and simple. The colder the weather, the more they chatter. And they've been chattering around some people's vehicle windshields who have talked to me about this, and I said, go get new wipers. That's it for this week's version on wiper maintenance. Other things that are going on that excite me, and Jay may be up on it or may not, but we'll find out when he talks, is that the new 2026 Jeep Cherokee is apparently on the road and has been at least looked at initially by one of the motor magazines, Motor Trend. And I read it, and I am not happy with what I am reading about my favorite vehicle in the Jeep lineup, which I think I mentioned on this show, is my versions of the Jeep Cherokee, of which I happen to be responsible for four in my family.
At a later point, I'd like to come back to those Cherokees for a different reason. Just talking about engines.
Okay. Well, let me get through
because I read that article about the new Cherokee too. So I do.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's fine, Jay. We look forward to that because while it's not in your inventory, you are very knowledgeable about vehicles. The new Cherokee, unfortunately, and that's my
expert opinion.
Expert opinion only. It may sell like pancakes, but I'm not sure. It's going to be 8 inches longer than the vehicles that it is now replacing. The last generation of the Jeep Cherokee vehicles that ended in 2023 with a very few versions with a 2024 sticker, also making it to the market as they were running out of inventory. It has got a lower powered motor, although there is a hybrid version which will boost that a little bit. That does not have the apparent horsepower rating of two versions of the last generation's engines, which was a V6 and a turbocharged turbocharged 4. And let me tell you, for those of us who have the vehicles with those two engines, one is sort of a slug, and the turbo 4 is quite sprightly and very interesting to have in my Jeep inventory. The new one, according to Motor Trend, the new Jeep Cherokee is underpowered in their pros and cons list, which they do at the top of their articles. And it's also going to be struggling, apparently, in sand, deep sand conditions with the new CVT transmission that is coming through with, at least in the initial production range of the vehicles that Motor Trend was able to talk about. I've been thinking a lot about a CVT transmission in an all-wheel drive Jeep as opposed to where they exist in other passenger cars. And, Jay, you may have more to say. I was trying to figure out how a CVT transmission could possibly get four wheels, much less one or two wheels or four wheels, churning if you were on a beach where you can be in Daytona, Florida, for example, and you were happening to park your Jeep along the beach, and maybe the tide was coming in, and maybe the Jeep sank a little bit into it, and you were trying to get out of that sand park
Let me barge
condition.
In. Okay, Let me barge in. First of all, there are all-wheel drive CVT power vehicles out there. Subaru's been making all-wheel drive vehicles since the longest of times, and they've had CVTs in their cars in the Outback.
I understand that, Jay.
since 2000.
But the point is, if you're using a vehicle off-road, while the CVTs work wonderfully on highways and firm ground, as you have been known to experience, they may or may not be effective in mud and or sand conditions, okay? And we won't know until somebody tries it.
The CVT has nothing to do with the way the power is being directed to the ground. I mean, if it's an all-wheel drive vehicle all the time, like the Subarus are, it will do just fine in the sand. And by the way, there's not a whole heck of a lot of sand around here to drive around.
That's right. I'm not trying
to market the Jeep to this locale.
I'm just talking about to our listeners. Listeners, listen to this because we're arguing that the new Jeep is about to arrive, and I am right now not interested in upgrading my versions of the Jeep Cherokee from the last generation. Clear and simple until I drive one. I'm waiting to drive one anxiously, but the other things that Motor Trend came up with is they said there was some kind of felt-like underbody covering which snagged thorny branches and or other things as they were going maybe slightly off-road somewhere. And why would anyone want a Jeep with a soft belly, underbelly? Jay, you can talk about that too.
I can. I think Jeep is figuring out that 99% of the people will buy these vehicles and have been buying, whether Cherokees, Grand Cherokees, or even Wranglers, 99% of the people never go off-road to begin with. So,
as is the case with the Subarus, the Toyota RAV4s, the Honda
correct.
CRVs, and the like. So do we need a Jeep-like vehicle like the Wrangler and the Bronco? Or just
do we need those two and not anything else that can imitate their workings
if the 1 to 10% that want to go off-road in those vehicles instead of the true-blooded Broncos and Wranglers can do anytime they want.
Well,
it's image. It's basically part of this is image. And Jeep is softening the image, in my opinion, of the 26.
I totally agree with you. I think Jeep has been softening the image.
They have.
Is your expression for a long time. And I think that in the end, it is going to, if not kill the Jeep brand, it's going to just make it a lot less meaningful, and people will not think of rugged vehicles necessarily when they think of Jeeps. Same thing can be said of the Land Rover Defender, for that matter, which the original Defender, which was built since just after World War II and was built for, I don't know, 40, 50 years, was the example of the all-terrain vehicle, and it was used throughout the world. The new Defender is just a street vehicle that, from what I hear from local car shops, is not necessarily very effectively assembled and is a nightmare in maintenance. Long story short, I don't think the image of Land Rover, Range Rover today is necessarily one of an all-terrain, rugged vehicle, and it doesn't necessarily need to be. And I think the same thing will be the future of Jeep. But that's just,
That's possibly true, but it's happened with a lot of the softening of these vehicles, which is what you've been talking about across the board, and versus the other newer makes such as the Honda CRV and the Toyota RAV4 trying to go slightly in the and the Honda Pilot are all trying to go in the reverse direction in people's minds, trying to convince them that their vehicles could do what the Jeeps, only the Jeeps and the Defenders used to be able to do back in the days of World War II or whatever. To that point, Jeep has just come out with the Moab version of the Wrangler with a super high-performance V8 and a super low, well, super affordable for those who can afford $80,000 vehicles, price tag on it. And so, as Motor Trend says on that, the 2026 Jeep Wrangler Moab 392 packs a Hemi, big tires, and a surprising price tag. And that would counter any of my comments about the softening of the new coming 26 Jeep Cherokee, which I will try to drive and give another report on later on. But I did not like the specs that the like the specs that the Motor Trend was commenting on about being 8 inches bigger, which is what usually happens to vehicles that come out, and for whatever reason, they seem to be perfectly sized for some people, but the designers have to change things like wheelbase and length of the this particular model of the vehicle, of the Jeep lineup, whereas you could simply buy a Grand Cherokee if you wanted one with longer wheelbase and more rear compartment capacity. So in short, it will be on tap for people to buy, probably it said in the fourth quarter of 25, which is what we're in right now. And I will stop there, Jay, because I don't think we need to communicate anymore about the Jeep Cherokee in the way I wanted to do it. But there we go.
The Jeep Cherokee is, like you say, the newer versions get bigger, blander, and all vehicles tend to look and drive the
better.
Same and have less personality and just cater
right.
to a larger audience.
And I think it's too bad that they're all the manufacturers are generally doing this. The Range Rovers or the Defenders are included. I think you've probably seen in the Range Rover, Land Rover lineup, and I guess we got to define this. Decipher what the Land Rover line is versus the Range Rover. The Range Rovers are those, you know, the super expensive high-end, and I don't think anybody would ever take one of those off the road. But the Defenders, as you said in the beginning, used to be the landmark go-to rough road, our off-road vehicle, besides, let's say, the Jeep Wranglers back in those days when they were used by the Army to go over all the rocks and terrain.
So today, if you really do want an off-terrain vehicle like an old Land Rover, you can buy them. There are plenty for sale in the used market that have been refurbished, both with V8 engines or diesel engines, short wheelbase, long wheelbase. There are plenty of them out there. Or you can go out and buy a new Ineos Grenadier.
Ineos Grenadier.
As we've talked
exactly.
about before. But yeah. I can't wait to see you trade in a few of your Jeeps and buy a Jeep Wrangler Moab.
I am not going to. The mileage rating on that, I believe, is below 20 miles per gallon average. City's probably 15, and I don't want to drive any vehicle that can't get at least 25 to 30 miles per gallon over an average tank full for the rest of my existence on the planet.
So I can't believe I'm going to say this, but I'm going to ask you to talk a little bit more about your Jeeps, because I wanted to talk about these four-cylinder engines that have been populating all of the new cars of late.
Okay, I'm happy to do that. I have the Wranglers. I will give a minute or two to this topic, Jay. I have Jeep Cherokees with all the engines available to them from the time they first brought this out in 2014.
I want to put this in perspective.
Okay.
The history of the four-cylinder turbo engine, first of all, those engines came out in the 1970s. I think the first production car that had a four-cylinder, two-liter turbo engine was the BMW 2002. I don't know if you must remember that, Rob.
I think you're probably right. I never have driven BMWs. Skip Barber Racing School.
And, before that, in the mid-70s, when we still had 2002s, and there are a few of them in town, by the way, there's a green one and there's a red one, for sure. Same owner, I believe. If he's out there, we'd love to hear from him. The turbo engine was initially a very hard to drive engine. The turbo is
known for lag.
The turbo lag. What is turbo lag? Due to the fact that the turbo charger is powered by the exhaust gases, and then that spins a turbo, which in turn rams in more air into the intake, and thus you can have more power. And this is a very bad, short explanation. Over the years, turbo supercharged engines have become a lot easier to drive and have actually become high torque at low RPM engines, and also get better fuel mileage than other V6, let's say, engines. And so manufacturers have been putting them in their cars, and Audi has them. The Audi Porsche VW group has a 2-liter four-cylinder engine that works extremely well, and I believe you can talk about one of them because you have an Audi Turbo 4, I believe, or two of them, actually. The BMW sounds a little bit like a diesel, but works, is very efficient as well. The Volvo engine, for some reason, seems to not get very good gas mileage. And I've been driving all these, mid-size SUVs with these engines, and mostly they're pretty good. And I have one exception, and I hate to say this, but the new Lexus RX 350 now has a Turbo 4. Toyota has replaced the V6 engine with the Turbo 4 for all the same reasons as everybody else: more torque,
more economy,
and better fuel economy. But in the Lexus, it just sounds like a tractor. It's not quiet. And it's not a pleasant noise.
Well, being that it's a Lexus, it means it's a Toyota. And surprisingly enough, you do not find the same noise in the Toyota four-cylinder turbos, I believe. So why would the Lexus have this engine noise problem as you are?
The Lexus is an upscale Toyota.
Yes, it is.
And Lexus with the V6 or V8s were always very, very quiet. This new RX 350 is, you can definitely hear the engine. Now, granted, when everything else is quiet, you tend to hear the one source of noise that cannot be
quieted.
Quieted, yeah. Like in electric cars, you will hear. You will hear road noise, right? You'll hear the tire noise,
right?
Because there's no engine, and the electric motors are a lot more quieter than gas engines. But again, I was disappointed in the Lexus four-cylinder turbo engine,
okay.
And I honestly did not notice any real fuel mileage improvement.
Right.
But,
well, you started out this topic asking me to comment on my knowledge of four-cylinder engines because I happen to have them in the Jeep Cherokee.
Well,
I could give the listeners...
Specifically the turbo versus the V6, which is what I wanted to...
Well, the turbo, the most economical driven, not like you're trying to go from 0 to 60 in 5 seconds or so, the turbo engine in the Jeep lineup is the most economical engine gas mileage-wise of the three engines. The regular four, which came on my 2014 and was then only partnered with an alternative engine, which was the V6, was always deemed as sluggish, which it is, but it was also slated to get 29 miles on the sticker highway and somewhere between 22 and 23 on the city range and something in between as an average. And come to find out that my 2014 Jeep with that engine, the original engine, was indeed able to get 29 miles a gallon, or 30, let's say 30, very new into its possession by me in a trip I took to Florida. And that was going at speeds of 70 miles an hour, but on very flat roads, as you know them to be at that level. You didn't have mountains to go over. And hill and dales and that kind of thing, where obviously when you're going uphill, any engine is going to have a significant reduction in the instant miles per gallon rating that will show up in any computer back then. But the turbo 4 in my Cherokees driven, I can get an average of over 30 miles a gallon, which is above the sticker rating. I think it's 29 for that and 21 city for the turbo, but I can get an average driven appropriately without being complaining
so
about
the,
it.
The comparison of
30
is
miles down
the V6,
for a tank full. And the V6, I drove a Cherokee out to Denver, Colorado, and on flat terrain, the V6 was doing between 28 and 29 miles per gallon, and it was an unloaded vehicle at that point. Much to my surprise, it was that good. It never got over 30 miles per gallon in any of the several tankfuls I was able to measure it on. And it was not as sprightly in acceleration either that the Turbo 4 was. So the Turbo 4s, as you have noted, did provide a lot of accelerative feel and efficiency over non-Turbo 4 engines and even over some V6 engines, which may have had a higher horsepower rating.
So how would you compare the the engine in the Jeep, the four-cylinder turbo in the Jeep, to the Audi engine? Same architecture, same power output, give or take a few horsepower.
I think the Audi Turbo 4s that I have driven of recent vintage are also very effectively effective engines. The acceleration seems to be similar to the Jeeps. I'm sure the drivetrain ratio of the axles are much higher in the Audis. That is the lower revs at the same miles per hour that the Jeeps would alternatively give you or show you on the tachometers, which are also disappearing from some of these cars. I haven't had, I couldn't tell you that I'm correct in that assessment, but they are pretty good engines, and they were used in Volkswagens also.
I find
the GTIs, for example.
Yeah, I find that Turbo 4 to be really a sweet, sweet.
Yes,
engine.
And I think the mileage was also pretty good in them.
It is.
You've got
something
some things to move
something
on
else,
to, right?
And you know, Tesla always seems to come up in the conversation in one way or another. And before we talk maybe about tanking sales, but I read a couple articles where Tesla and Apple, the two big names, the names have come together. I went over an article very quickly that mentioned that Tesla was considering installing CarPlay in their cars, and there's no assurance that that will actually happen, but they were at least considering it, which is the reverse trend of most manufacturers to try to weed out both Android and CarPlay.
I know. I saw that recently, Jay. Why is that? I don't know.
Well, everybody wants to have their own system. I know, we talked about it, I think, a few weeks ago about Rivian weeding out Apple CarPlay. Other manufacturers, GM, Ford, everybody wants to have their own infotainment system and try to keep Apple and Android out of the equation. I think it's a mistake.
I do too. I think that's they probably have to pay royalties to those companies when they use their equipment. And everybody, they're always trying to figure out how to make the next generation of their vehicles less expensive to construct and put out on the streets. And that was the only thing I could think that they would what they're trying to avoid in the future, if they can delete the Android and Apple CarPlay options, or that now are standard on pretty much all the existing vehicles, right, from their
yes.
future systems.
Because
they will be
well
able to produce their systems differently.
Yeah. I thought maybe that the Tesla was doing that because, on the other hand, there's also I just read a blip about the next Apple iPhone, like the 18 Pro, would have Starlink incorporated in the phone itself, and I thought, that would be interesting. And then I saw the article on Tesla and Apple, and I thought, okay, well, maybe those two stories are not totally unrelated, but we'll see.
Yep.
But I know you mentioned in your pre-show notes, the Chinese market is struggling, and we know Tesla is struggling in China, but it's not just Tesla struggling in China. Chinese manufacturers are struggling, and Tesla is struggling here too. But I think the auto industry in general is struggling.
Well, yes, I agree with all of that. What I heard on Business News edition of a news program this morning was that there's such a glut of, there's so many makers of Chinese cars, and they're so cheap. It sounded to me like they were implying maybe that the Chinese market of purchases was saturated with electric vehicles, but they're still producing them as if they were, you know, selling everyone off the truck. That was not mentioned in this radio show, but they're piling up on lots. And where can they go, Jay? I figure they can go to Europe.
Well,
but they're not going to come to the U.S. But there's going to be consolidation. There's probably bankruptcy. The show alleged that they were being produced sold at below the cost of, it cost them to build them, even though they can do them much less expensively than we can and Tesla can for models that you have already reported on this show that are more advanced than anything that we are producing in the U.S. and maybe are being produced by the manufacturers in Europe.
Well, I was reading an editorial by Peter DiLorenzo from the Auto Extremist, who is a doom and gloom, sarcastic journalist, a former PR executive in Detroit, and who's been writing for the last 20, 25 years. And although I disagree with him on a lot of topics, I was kind of in agreement with his doom and gloom view that, you know, the problems the Chinese manufacturers are having in China are not necessarily good for other manufacturers, and the U.S. manufacturers are struggling, and the European manufacturers too. And most likely, you know, all the investment in the electric car business has been funded by sales of ICE cars, right? The gas engine have still been the bread and butter of auto manufacturers, and a lot of those profits have been reinvested in developing EVs. And now the EV market is kind of up in the air because subsidies are being retracted left and right, and who knows, where we're going from here. So,
well, the Chinese are manufacturing all the components of their cars in-house, unlike the U.S., which is manufacturing some of the stuff here, but then they go out and get engines from Mexico or engines from Europe or other transmissions from Europe, et cetera, and all of which cost a lot more money to bring into their manufacturing plant from cost of transportation to the cost of the products. Whereas the Chinese just build everything right there, and they do it with what's their labor cost? About 10% of what any of our labor costs are per hour, per hour of workmanship of building whatever that is they're building as they go along. And they're also being subsidized by the Chinese government. I'm not sure this is what our listeners want to listen to, but anyways, so be it. But as what the Americans have done, did you tell us last week that Ford is stopping production of the Lightning? I heard that was going to happen. They've already
momentarily stopping. I mean, I don't
momentarily.
Think
you're correct because they're not selling anywhere near enough to make an hourly rate of production probably profitable to them.
Well,
and that may be happening to Chevrolet too. I don't know. But hybrid is the game that seems to be going forward in the news circles on our version, the American version of transition from ICE cars to, if not all electric, a hybrid version of vehicles that get also excellent mileage compared to the ICE alone, and yet don't have some of the operational problems of full electric, which mainly means you have to have chargers around, starting from your own garage to wherever along any route you're going to take. And while there's increasing numbers of the chargers, as you point out to us weekly when I say there aren't enough chargers, it's still,
chargers are not very expensive to put in, I found out. I know somebody that says the components cost roughly $600 to $700 for a level 2 charger. I'm not sure that's accurate, but this is what this person said. And then the installation was, you know, I don't know what the installation costs. It depends on what you have to do to upgrade your electric panel if you don't have enough to have at least a 40-amp circuit available in your panel. But I've heard that you know, manufacturers were putting in chargers for customers of their cars. I think Hyundai was one in one marketing ploy of several years back. If you bought a Hyundai Electric, they would put it. They would pay for the charger installation. And I don't think it's probably much more than $2,500. Do you have any idea what it costs to put a charger in?
No.
Well, we'll have to do some research on that and come back next week, okay?
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
So until next week's show, we are Jay DeMarkin and Robin Leach for this week. And thank you for listening.
Car Keys with Robin Leach and Jay DeMarkin is produced at the facilities of WHDD 91.9 FM, RobinHoodRadio.com, Sharon, Connecticut.